welcome to episode 44 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at UNC Charlotte. And today I'm talking again, actually, to Christine Wade, who is professor of political science and international studies at Washington College. She studies Central America, recently published a book, Captured Peace, Elites and Peace Building in El Salvador, and also the ninth edition of the textbook Latin American Politics and Development. So Christine, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Craig.
So today we're going to talk about Honduras. And I won't go into any sort of lengthy discussion of where we are, but we had a presidential election in November, which was a mess, calls of fraud. It took the Electoral Tribunal forever to figure out what it was doing. After several weeks, Juan Orlando Hernandez was declared the winner over Salvador Nasralla. And then shortly thereafter, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico all congratulated him, even though the OAS said that there was clear evidence of fraud. The OAS actually said there should be a new election. So here we are with somebody who's been proclaimed winner, and the proclaimed losers are calling for protests. And so let me just start with, does the election have any legitimacy at all?
You know, Greg, it's really difficult to look at the events that have unfolded since late November and think that there's any legitimacy to these elections. We refer to the elections, perhaps the November 2009 elections, as being highly problematic, you know, the elections that followed the coup. This is the third set of elections since the 2009 coup, and they've all been highly flawed, if not illegitimate.
And it seemed like, at least from what I've seen, like Latin American Public Opinion Project, is that Hondurans themselves, in general, they have almost no faith in elections. Would you say that's accurate?
I think that's true. Hondurans tend to demonstrate far more distrust in elections than other Central Americans, which is saying quite a bit, if you think about it. From other polls over the past 2 years, were widely opposed to re-election. And so when we combine those two factors together, I don't think it's surprising that we see contentious elections in November.
Yeah, and I mean, I hadn't even mentioned that part, that we have the crazy bit where Mel Zelaya was overthrown for even just thinking about re-election, and now Hernandez is saying, oh, well, I should be re-elected. So, I mean, it's even just the idea of being re-elected itself is problematic.
Yeah. Well, I've long maintained, though, that the specter of re-election in 2009 was merely a pretense for getting rid of Mel Zelaya. There was chance that Mel Zelaya was going to be able to run for elections. It would have had nothing to do with the 2009 elections. It was the question of whether or not to hold a poll to later add a ballot in November on the constitutional question of re-election. It would have had no impact on him being returned to office that year. And I think had far more to do with the economic ideas of Zelaya versus the oligarchy in Honduras. But that said, the public opinion as being adverse to re-election is one that is very strong. In fact, I think we're nearly or at 60% of the population opposing re-election that we've seen in polls. So it's no surprise, I think, that the question of Hernandez's potential re-election was quite contested.
And so thinking about just sort of general popular concern about re-election and about the election itself, is the opposition united enough to sustain protests? And then the sort of follow-up is, like, what would these protests achieve?
Right. Well, I think that it's an interesting question about the opposition, right? We know that the opposition entered into alliance for the purposes of the election.
Right.
And how this would have worked in terms of governance remains a great unknown. In fact, because Nasralla and some segments of Libre are actually quite different from one another. Nasralla is now a man without a party. He has no party affiliation. He said he's starting a mass movement. So he certainly seems to be engaged still in perhaps some sort of long game in Honduran politics. Whether or not he can sustain any type of broad movement without political affiliation remains unknown. Libre, on the other hand, and supporters of Libre, I actually think, you know, have a far greater chance of sustaining protests and opposition going forward. But there's no doubt that Nasrallah was a really important component in the opposition's popularity for the November elections.
And what do you think that, so what are they hoping to achieve? I mean, force new elections or what?
Well, I think that it's unlikely that they're going to force new elections. And Juan Orlando Hernandez has no reason, and there's no external pressure on him to concede in any way, shape, or form. His offer of dialogue, which he's offered before, is largely lip service to the opposition, and I think they'd be foolish to take him too seriously. But I think the intention is to keep up pressure on the Hernandez administration, potentially to create problems for him in terms of international or foreign aid, and to force some concessions, perhaps. But I think that it's probably, the impact will probably be fairly limited, given the extent to which he's concentrated power in his hands.
Yeah, and you think, what I was thinking too, is that it's now, what, 9 years since, or almost 9 years since the coup.
Right.
And there were protests just all the time. There was lots of protests, but it didn't actually end up fundamentally changing the political system.
Yeah, and even if we look even to more recently to summer 2015, right, when we had the torch marches in Honduras versus what was happening in Guatemala, the impact of the protests in Guatemala, which ultimately brought down the government, right, far more impactful. But I think we're looking at a regime that's much stronger in Honduras, certainly more authoritarian, but where there are fewer cracks within the elite for those protesters to take advantage of.
And so maybe we're already answering my next question, but is that, what are the chances that Hernandez completes a four-year term?
Well, I think probably pretty good, frankly. And I'm not happy about that, but I think they're actually probably pretty good that he remains in office for the duration of the term. That said, I don't think we can rule out any sort of other broader movement that seeks to remove him from office.
And would it be sort of like in Venezuela, at least conventional wisdom is that a lot of this hinges on support of the military. And I know this isn't necessarily your expertise, but do you get a sense then that the military is pretty solidly behind the oligarchy and solidly behind him as a result?
Well, it would appear to be that way. You know, during the protests, we saw a very brief crack. Where the police said, you know, we're not going to enforce this curfew. We're not going to repress protesters. And there was this debate about whether or not this was the police were really acting on the behalf of the protesters or on behalf, frankly, of defending the Constitution, or whether it was a ploy to get concessions out of the Hernandez administration. And about 24 hours later, it turned out that the skeptics were probably right, that it appeared that they were trying to get concessions from the Hernandez administration. But it does show that without, I think, the police and military, that Juan Orlando's government is considerably weaker. So the question is, will there ever be any cracks, right, in that relationship? He desperately needs them to stay in power.
Well, I guess then, if you want to, like comparing to Venezuela, is that he'll pay very close attention to their wages and benefits.
Sure. And that was one of the points of contention, right? With the police strike, one of the questions was about wages.
Yeah.
And the 24-hour police strike. And those conditions appeared to have been met. But the question is, I think in large part, you know, how long he can sustain that as he comes under increased international scrutiny. I don't think there's going to be any end to the United States' support for militarized policing in Honduras. because clearly the United States views the Hernandez administration as a key ally, although I increasingly wonder what the possible rationale for that is. That funding is crucial to keeping his relationship with military and police intact.
Yeah, you know, my sort of hunch is that a lot of this hinges on John Kelly, who, as head of Southcom, believed that Hernandez was doing a good job. So I kind of wonder how much that's also helping to drive the Trump administration's position on Honduras.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did read, I thought, that Honduras's drug interdiction decreased last year. So I'm not entirely clear whether Honduras has been quite the ally that the United States perceives it to be.
Yeah. And this kind of relates to the military, too. Are we pretty much guaranteed to see increased violence in the near future as these protests rev up? And what about longer term?
Well, certainly the Honduran military and military police have been engaging in pretty brutal repression in response to these protests. We've got now over 30 people killed. Some of them include children, releasing of or throwing tear gas canisters into private homes, hunting down protesters in their homes. And it is certainly reminiscent of the environment in Honduras following the 2009 coup. The question is really whether or not this type of repression will continue to have legs. I think that we're increasingly seeing Hondurans as being fed up with this type of behavior, not only by the military and the police, but the corruption perpetrated by the oligarchy and elites in Honduras. And so I think that there's a good chance that the outcome of the election sparks new coalitions within society, perhaps new social movements, but you know they can't live by repression forever. And I think that they'll discover that sooner rather than later.
Well, maybe the military and police start getting repression fatigue too.
Right. And also the question becomes, you know, I think as we look at, and this is really a great question for Orlando Perez, by the way, do we have multi-class police and military systems?
Yeah.
And how deeply will those, right, from the working classes feel affected and impacted by, frankly, what is a highly deteriorating economy? Their families are going to be feeling the brunt of this. Inequality in Honduras has skyrocketed. So this whole notion that existed prior to the election that Hernandez would benefit from a strong economy for a very small subset of Hondurans, right?
Right. I was trying to think of comparisons of the Honduran situation to see if we get any kind of grip on it. And I thought of the Mexican presidential elections of 2006, where you had a highly contested, very close election where the loser, López Obrador, says, okay, well, I don't believe I lost. And he camped out in Mexico City for, I think it was several months, and
yes,
then proclaimed himself to be a shadow government. And then
had a cabinet.
Yeah, and then it just yeah, kind of petered out. Mexicans right, themselves, I think, got kind of tired of it. And I wondered whether we might see a similar kind of dynamic.
I'm not sure. And I think part of this is because Nasrallah himself has never held, he's not a politico. I mean, he's
sure,
never held elected political office. He's a bit of an unknown. It's hard to know how he sees this playing out, in particular for himself. I think he's playing a long game. Certainly, the politicians within Libre are far more experienced and far more calculating, I think, than Nasrallah is. I would imagine that they are working with their base to find ways to sustain this protest. But for sure, the next month, right, the opposition has already called for ongoing protests from this point up until Hernandez's inauguration.
Actually, that's true. I hadn't sort of thought of the fact that Nasrallah himself is kind of this outsider, and that the person who you would probably compare López Obrador to is Zelaya.
Yes.
But the two of them are not, doesn't seem to me to be on the same page at all. And I think like the alliance has pretty much just fallen apart, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the alliance existed for the election, and without the election, there's no alliance. I mean, I think that's the easiest way to look at it. Nasrallah, as I mentioned earlier, is a man without a party. The PAC was completely co-opted by Hernandez's party, so he doesn't have a party to return to. He's not a member of Libre. It's not part of his ideological affiliation. And so probably thinking of certainly as Zelaya, as you know, the outsider candidate is probably more useful in that situation.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, that is one difference with Mexico, because otherwise I just thought this has been a really weird election with weird coalitions, so that it made it hard to compare.
Yeah, we have also seen something really interesting out of the Liberal Party, right? And so the Liberal Party chose to run a fairly unconventional candidate, Luis Zelaya, who was also not a politico, a professor. And I think seeing the way that Luis Zelaya behaved during the elections is also something really important to take note of, particularly if we wanted to think about what Congress is going to be like. I mean, no doubt there's potential there for a Libre Liberal Party alliance.
Okay. Thinking of the U.S. side, does the U.S. lose credibility regionally by accepting the result, or was there not much credibility to lose?
I think this is the tough part. I think increasingly the United States has very little credibility in the region. I think in some ways not at all surprising if we think back to the U.S. position in 2009. And if we think about the character of the current administration, I don't think the U.S. embassy's behavior or that of the USG more broadly is particularly surprising in this case. But it's going to be increasingly difficult for the United States to give lip service to being the guarantor of democracy in the hemisphere, given its support for the Honduran elections. And frankly, the outright payola that appears to have happened with Honduras's vote in the United Nations, recognizing, you know, Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I mean, it looks so tit for tat, it's not even funny anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the teeny Pacific countries that would routinely vote with the U.S., to reject the condemnation of the Cuba embargo. Right.
Right.
I mean, these places that had like 15,000 population, but they're like, sure, we're voting with the U.S.
Right. Yeah. Now, there is some, we can't deny that there's some affinity or long-term affinity going back for both Guatemala and Honduras with their relationship with Israel, and Israel providing arms, of course, and training to both of those armies. But the timing of it looks really bad. I mean, the timing of the U.S. certification, which was in the middle of this election debacle, certainly leaves a really bad taste in one's mouth. It's difficult to watch the State Department and the Trump administration supporting protesters in Iran or making statements about Venezuela, but giving a pass to Honduras.
Right. And, you know, one of the things when I was thinking about not much credibility, okay, we know that the Trump administration, Trump himself, isn't particularly concerned with hypocrisy, but there's also quite a bit of unhappiness with the Obama administration's response, Hillary Clinton's response, right?
Yes.
So how much in Honduras, was that U.S. credibility shot a long time ago or what?
You know, I think it was. I mean, I think that the lingering anger and distrust in Honduras, from the 2009 coup and the U.S. response to that never went away. It never left. And I think that this is why so many people in the opposition really never expected the United States to do anything other than to support an Hernandez victory.
Yeah.
So, I would just say similarly, sorry, I didn't mean
no,
to interrupt
go ahead.
I would just say similarly, what's interesting is that the Organization of American States also has had very little credibility in Honduras since the coup and since the dealings setting up the MACSI, the Anti-Corruption Commission. And the opposition really felt that the OAS was a very weak guarantor of this institution. So it's interesting, actually, I think, for the Organization of American States to have come out to be so critical about these elections. Perhaps buys the OAS a little more credibility with the Honduran opposition this go-around.
Yeah, and then the problem with the OAS is that whether it's seen as legitimate or not, it just doesn't have any power.
That's right.
And so if you don't have the backing, I mean, you just think of the the bigger powers in the region, you know, Brazil, other, you know, other countries, it's like they're sort of just not, they're just not there.
Yeah.
And the U.S., of course, was already saying that it thought the election was legitimate. So, it, you know, it's almost like moot whether you think the OAS is legitimate or not, because no matter what it decides, you can have the Secretary General making speeches, but that's then the about extent of it.
That's exactly right.
So, with an open-ended question, is there any room for optimism? Do you see optimism? Is there the glass half full anywhere?
Well, it's hard, but I do think that the mobilization that we've seen over the past 2.5 years is a point of optimism. I really do. I think the fact that so many of the young people from multiple classes who went out into the streets in the summer of 2015 and marched against corruption, and I was lucky to participate in some of those torch marches. I mean, it's just unbelievable the energy that exists. And people are increasingly engaging in political discourse and aware of corruption and fed up with corruption. So I think that this is potentially a bright spot in Honduras. I'd also say that I was, and I don't want to overstate this, but I was pleased with the way that the Liberal Party, and again, candidate Luis Zelaya, behaved during the election process. Because I think it showed that one of Honduras's historic parties is still capable of resuscitating some type of legitimate leadership in these situations. Luis Zelaya came out looking like the most reasonable person, frankly, in Honduras in the midst of all of this. He was very quick to support Nasrallah. He was very quick to question the TSE. And his public statements have been very measured, thoughtful, and calm. And, you know, a couple of years ago, we were sort of talking about the potential death of the Liberal Party. But perhaps that's not so. I'm not suggesting it's worth saving. But, you know, as people increasingly look towards alternatives in Honduras, the question is where are people going to go?
Establishment.
Yeah, right. Well, Honduras has lots of small parties or micro parties that have fractions of seats in Congress. But the big divide is going to be between the National Party, Hernandez's party, right, the Liberal Party and Libre. And if Libre and the Liberal Party can somehow work together, they might help. It might potentially stop some of the bigger things that the Hernandez administration is hoping to do in the coming term.
Okay, so at least what we can say maybe is that there is – perhaps a reduction in the amount of apathy that the average Honduran thinks, perhaps even more so young Hondurans, and that unlike a lot of other places in the hemisphere, is that some established parties actually know how to run and respond to political crisis.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really nice synthesis. I was just thinking it's so much less wordy than what I just said,
okay.
Greg.
That was still pretty wordy for me. Anyway, though. Yes.
Yeah, no, I think that those things are true. If you're looking for the bright spot in Honduras, I can see that it's hard to see these things in the midst of this crisis at the moment, though, for sure.
Well, see, I'm trying to end on a positive note because, I mean, so many of the podcasts that I'm doing, we end up sort of joking about how depressing this whole thing was because we're talking about DACA or we're talking about Venezuela or whatever. So I thought, okay, this time I at least got to try to do something to not end on a complete down note.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great. It's good to end on something positive. And I think that we don't want to overlook those areas because those are areas of opportunities for breaking the strain of authoritarianism in Honduras. And there are advantages in Honduras that don't necessarily exist in some other countries, right? Where you might have a decent, viable opposition politicians who are capable of winning seats and are, politically competent. You look next door in Nicaragua, and this is harder to see, where we have, opposition parties that are basically out to lunch and have allowed, again, the Ortega administration to sort of amass political control. There's more of a counterbalance, I think, in Honduras, but we should never underestimate the strength of the Hernandez administration and the lengths to which he's willing to go to further concentrate his own power.
Right.
I just undid your positive note.
No, I know. I was like, okay, so we're out of time, because if we keep talking, then there's no way that we could say this positive for very long. So I've been talking to Christine Wade, who's professor of political science and international studies at Washington College. And thank you so much again for taking the time.
Thanks for having me, Greg.